All right. Well, thanks everybody for coming. It's much appreciated. This is probably good. This limits my exposure to embarrassment here. So I am Ben Rao. I'm a recent graduate of the University of Nevada, Reno. And I just want to mention my co-authors here, Dale Johnson, who is in the room, Bob Blank, and Ann Lucchesi. And the Joint Fire Science Program, I want to thanks for funding this work, and SageStep and University of Nevada, Reno for facilitating this. So I just want to talk to you a little bit today about woodland encroachment and the effects of carbon and nitrogen. And we had the opportunity to collect a lot of data using the SageStep network, which was funded by Joint Fire Sciences. And we're interested in carbon and nitrogen for obvious reasons. I don't think we have to argue that point anymore. But one of the things that I think we're going to start seeing is public policy and changes in land management as we start to move towards cap and trade programs and emissions offsets and things of that nature. And those are going to have, I think, dramatic influences on forest and rain management and agricultural practices. Currently, we don't know a whole ton about the Great Basin, especially sagebrush and pinyon juniper woodlands. It's kind of in the middle of nowhere and been somewhat forgotten. There's some people who have certainly done quite a bit of work there, and so there is some knowledge. It's not a completely lacking. We know there's been a lot of land use history in these areas. Grazing, fire suppression, mining, and agriculture have all had significant influences in the region. Starting around 1860, we saw some serious increases in tree establishment and tree cover on the landscape. That was probably due to the effects of grazing, fire suppression, yada, yada, yada. We also saw the introduction of exotic invasive grasses into the region, Bromus tectorum, which has become a huge problem. These vegetation transitions, tree establishment, and Bromus tectorum are certainly altering biogeochemical cycles within the region, changing fire regimes, altering microbial communities, and certainly affecting carbon and nitrogen storage. So some of the things we are interested in are essentially, they're kind of out of order there, but how woodland expansion influences carbon and nitrogen on the landscape. Is there any influence that geology has on below ground carbon and nitrogen? And essentially, how are carbon and nitrogen related on these landscapes? And so this is the SageStep network. So this is, if you're familiar with the fire and fire surrogate study, this is kind of the sagebrush version of that. And so we have 20 sites scattered throughout the Great Basin, ranging from all the way from Washington down to Utah, 13 woodland sites and 7 sites that are sage cheat sites. They are scattered across 2 geologies, or a smattering thereof. Down in the southeastern corner, that's typically carbonate geology, and anything in the northwest portion is typically basalt lava flow. There could be less deposits on top of that lava flow. There's a few other odds and ends out there. So at each one of these sites, there are basically 3 or 4 core plots, and those core plots receive some sort of fuels reduction treatment. It was either cutting or masticating or prescribed fire. These samples were taken all pre-treatment. And we also have, essentially within those control, cut, or burn treatments, there is a gradient of woodland encroachment. And so the phase one plots that we sampled essentially are shrub-dominated plots with very few trees on site. The phase two plots are essentially some sort of dominant, shared dominance of shrubs and trees. And the phase three plots are essentially tree-dominated sites with very little perennial herbaceous or shrub cover. So soil cores were collected from each one of these core plots within each site. Cores were taken down to a depth of 90 centimeters or until a bedrock or similar restriction was encountered. Essentially what we did was separate those out into less than 2 millimeter, greater than 2 millimeter, and root biomass. And so this is kind of we work with vegetation crews who actually measure all the biomass and vegetation within the subplot. And so we chose to actually take our samples from just outside the subplot to minimize disturbance. And we've been using this device right here. We stopped digging quantitative soil pits a couple years ago. We feel that this device gives us just as good of information, if not better, and it's certainly easier on your back. You can see essentially this thing is able to core through solid rock. That's a perfect 3-inch diameter piece of coarse fragment there that came out of that core. And so all you really need to do with this, we take samples in 15 centimeter increments. You core, bring the sample back to the lab, sieve it to 2 millimeters, separate out the rocks from the roots, and multiply by the depth in the area, and you got volume. So it works out pretty well for us. Basically what we ended up doing then was comparing woodland encroachment, phase of woodland encroachment and geology using SAS, PROC LIMX procedure, which is basically a mixed model. And we also used some multiple linear regression to analyze the relationship between carbon and nitrogen. And so this is a typical western juniper woodland in central Oregon. This is actually not too far from John Day or Mitchell, Oregon, if anyone's ever been up there. And so you can see on the landscape the trees occur in patches of very low tree dominance all the way through very high tree dominance with variable paraceous, perennial herbaceous understory components. And so looking at soil carbon, what we found from sampling these woodlands across the Intermountain West and looking at the two different geologies is that obviously the carbonate soils have considerably more carbon in them than the igneous or volcanic derived soils. And in the carbonate derived soils, the biggest chunk of that comes from inorganic carbon. But another pretty big chunk comes from rock carbon, which is also inorganic carbon predominantly. And then less than 21% typically is soil organic carbon, and less than 1% then is root carbon. And you can see the distribution quite a bit different then for the igneous or volcanic derived soils, where we have 82% of the carbon is actually soil organic carbon, and pretty even chunks actually in rocks and roots, which was kind of surprising to me. And also a pretty decent chunk of soil inorganic carbon. So these are secondary carbonates probably derived in situ. So taking a look then a little bit closer at the phase of woodland encroachment. So if you take a look at soil organic carbon, looking across phase one, phase two, phase three woodlands in carbonate soils versus the igneous-derived soils, you can see the carbonate-derived soils certainly are storing considerably more soil organic carbon than the igneous-derived soils. We have a feeling this is probably due to particle size distribution, mineralogy of the carbonate-derived soils, and also there's slight differences in the actual depth and mass of the soils. Carbonate soils in the region tend to be slightly deeper than igneous-derived soils, 65 to 75 centimeters as opposed to less than 60 centimeters for the igneous-derived soils. You can see there's no real influence of woodland encroachment on soil organic carbon there. If you use your imagination, you might be able to say that phase three woodlands have slightly more carbon than phase one or phase two. But the big difference certainly that we do see is actually in root-derived carbon. So as you put more trees in the landscape, you're certainly adding more below-ground carbon in the form of root biomass. And that's pretty linear relationship as you put more trees in the landscape. And there doesn't really appear to be any difference between the carbonate or the igneous-derived soils there. So that might add up to, you're maybe talking about 2 to 3 megagrams per hectare there, and starting from next to no trees in the landscape to up to about 60% tree cover on the landscape. And we take a look at kind of the vertical distribution of soil organic carbon and root carbon on these landscapes. And so being able to sample to 90 centimeters, you can see, if you take a look at the phase three woodlands, there's a slight increase in soil organic carbon near the surface, but that's offset almost equally by a decrease in the subsurface. And so you typically think of below ground carbon being driven by root biomass, and we see that as you enter into these phase three woodlands, you're starting to see much higher production of root biomass just below the surface. That's 15 to 30 centimeters increment, but it's not really reflected in the soil organic carbon pool. Some of the increases in soil organic carbon near the surface are probably due to increased litter fall near the soil surface. And the decrease at depth, I would hypothesize that that's probably due to a reduction at roots at depth and continued respiration, but we're not really sure at this point in time. And moving on to the soil nitrogen that we see within the systems, you can see there's really not much of a difference between the carbonate-derived soils and the igneous-derived soils, anywhere between 4 and 5.5 megagrams per hectare. Pretty even distribution too. What was kind of stunning here was the amount of nitrogen bound up in rock, up to anywhere between 10 and 12% for both of these systems, which is about 10 times more nitrogen than is actually found in root biomass in these systems. So looking at soil nitrogen across the woodland gradient, if you use your imagination there, you might be able to say that there could possibly be slightly more nitrogen in carbonate-derived soils than in these volcanic or igneous-derived soils. You might also be able to really use your imagination and say that as you put more trees in the landscape, you are starting to lose soil organic or soil nitrogen. It's, you know, the trend is kind of there, but it doesn't really stand out real well. We actually had some significant relationships with rock nitrogen and phase of woodland encroachment. I have absolutely no idea what they mean at this point in time. Maybe, who knows? If anyone has an idea, let me know. But then certainly root nitrogen follows that exact same pattern as root carbon. As you put more trees in the landscape, you certainly have more nitrogen stored in roots. And again, looking at the vertical distribution of root nitrogen and soil nitrogen, you see that same pulse in just below the subsurface as you put more trees on the landscape, but not a whole bunch of changes in actual soil nitrogen. You might see that, again, if we use our imagination, you might see an increase near the surface and a decrease in the subsurface. So you see the pattern for root nitrogen, root carbon, and soil nitrogen and soil carbon are pretty closely linked here, which would bring us to this, actually trying to determine the relationships between carbon and nitrogen on the landscape and trying to actually determine what drives the accumulation of soil carbon, soil organic carbon in these systems. And by far, using a multiple linear regression, a stepwise technique, where we keep adding and subtracting variables until we come up with a favorite model, below ground nitrogen really predicts something like 69% of the variance within the system. So if you know where total below ground nitrogen is, you have a pretty good idea of total below ground carbon. So really kind of emphasizing the link between carbon and nitrogen in these systems. And then if you have some information on the actual total depth of the soil regolith, and you know a little bit about the geology, you can actually start predicting more and more of the variance within the system. And finally down there near the bottom, when you add the variable tree cover, you finally start to explain some of the variance within the system. So tree cover is not really driving to a major extent the amount of below ground carbon storage, but it's certainly not insignificant either. And this is just kind of the observed versus predicted for that model. So up until the point where you get some really high numbers for soil organic carbon, you're able to pretty accurately predict what's going on with below ground nitrogen, geology, tree cover, and depth of the regolith. So just to kind of wrap things up, these woodlands occupy about 18 million hectares in the Intermountain West. Currently about 20% of these woodlands are in what we consider phase three. They're currently going through, the trees are there on the landscape now. They're just getting bigger. And so within about 50 years, we expect that 75% of the landscape will be these phase three type woodlands, these over 60% tree cover type woodlands. You know, certainly this alters ecosystem structure, increases the risk of wildfire, and if these things burn, you can be left with an exotic annual grass invasion, which I'll have some data for you next year. We can actually see some pretty significant losses in soil organic carbon once these exotic grasses move in. So so I think what we see here is that we have a relatively limited potential for soil organic carbon sequestration within these woodlands. By moving from a phase one to a phase three woodland, you might be able to stuff an additional 6.5 megagrams per hectare into the system. And you might get another 2 megagrams per hectare out of the roots, which if you average this out over a 50-year time period expected for these things to move from these phase one woodlands to a phase three woodland, you're talking about 177 kilograms per hectare per year, which is not too far off the bat from normal carbon accumulation, if I remember correctly. You start doing the multiplication, the back of the envelope calculations here, and you're talking about less than a gigaton per carbon. We also, from those vegetation plots that I showed, we're starting to crunch through those numbers now to do total ecosystem carbon and nitrogen budgets for these systems. And you could potentially, if you you know, got up to 65, 75, 85%, 90% tree cover, you might be able to stuff an additional 20 to 50 megagrams per hectare onto the landscape. It's somewhere between 0.2 and 0.5 gigatons over the 18 million hectares. I just want to thank guys like Robin Tausch, Rick Miller, Bruce Roundy, and all the field crews who helped collect the data on vegetation, biomass, my crew for assisting with the sample collection and sample processing. This is kind of a nightmare to process all these samples. The Forest Service, BLM, and all the Sage Step folks who made this possible. And with that, I guess I'll open that up to any questions. Thanks.
Too far over there?
Great job.
Thanks.
I got to ask you about rock carbon. What were your rocks? I saw your sampler, but are these
if you're
caliche in your samples?
In some areas, yeah. We didn't hit nearly as much as I would have expected. The only places we really ran into it were up on the Owyhee Plateau. If you move over towards eastern Nevada and Utah, those are mostly limestone-derived soils, carbonate rocks. And so that device cuts right through those, no problem, and you're able to pull them out intact. The other rug, we have a few, silica ash flow tuff is something that we found in Nevada. We also found some granitics in Nevada. As you move up into Idaho and Oregon, you're looking at mostly basalt lava flow covered with sometimes with loess deposits and sometimes not. So typically it's either granitics or ash flow tuffs, carbonates, or some of these basalts that are the rocks that we're able to cut through. The really high silica rocks you can't cut through, but so be it, I guess. Yes.
Got another question? Dale Cole has a question.
Surely.
I'm asking this out of complete ignorance because I know nothing of these systems, but I was just curious of the invasion of these sites with the forest. What's that due to? Is it simply the prior history of that area or the climate change?
There's still a lively debate. Some people will say that, you know, during the Comstock era of mining, that most of the woodlands were cut down and that those woodlands are now naturally the cutting stopped, those woodlands are regenerated really rapidly following the mining era. There's another group of folks who will say that basically due to livestock grazing, where you eliminate the perennial herbaceous fuels and fire suppression, you basically eliminate fire as a process on the landscape and therefore allow for woody invasion on the landscape. And so not only are you increasing the amount of sagebrush on these sites, but you're increasing the amount of woodlands. So whereas woodlands would have formerly been on rocky soils, you know, places that didn't have fuel, that didn't carry fire, now they're able to start moving into these areas of deeper soils, more productive soils, simply because you've removed the disturbance from the landscape. And so that would be one of the two hypotheses for woodland encroachment on the landscape. And for exotic invasives, they were introduced. The exotic cheatgrass was induced as an early season forage in the late 1800s, and once it got out, it pretty much goes where it wants to. Certainly fire will facilitate its spread. Certainly grazing will facilitate its spread. And once it's on the landscape, it's pretty tough to get rid of. Well, I'm a soil scientist, not an ecologist, but I think there's a little bit of taking a look around. You know, I think there's certainly some pretty good evidence out there that suggests that there was some long-term climate change, you know, with the Little Ice Age, that there was a period of very favorable tree establishment during the late 1800s. And when you combine that with some of the management that occurred in the area, you had a time when there was a lot of trees being put on the landscape. The establishment of the trees, if you look at the data, stops around 1920, 1930, and currently there's no real current establishment of trees occurring on the landscape. It looks at this point in time, it's the trees that are there, and they're just getting bigger.
That's what I was. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Can you say anything more about the paleo record of Pinyon and the juniper?
Sure. Probably not the best person to talk about this, but I know that the woodlands have moved north and south several times over the past 5,000-10,000 years, depending on how warm and how dry it is. And certainly, you know, they've moved as far south as the Mexican border and as far north as, their current range probably. And so they do have a, you know, depending on the climate, they will move north and south. Some of the current, the rates of expansion, though, are currently higher than what we think we would have expected due to normal climate change.
Yeah, interesting, Ben.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.